Let's go ahead and get started. It's 3:30 on the dot by Texas time, Texas Rangers time.
Watching the game tonight?
I don't know. I'm supposed to be doing some interviews. I may have been on silent or something. This year we thought to try to bring you at least one veterans roundtable where they might tell you a story or two that about their time at Thurlow or something related to their military time in World War II, and then we'll let the group answer questions of you, and some of the veterans in here might have corresponding stories that, or, you know, I don't know, you might have seen Walt hailing a cab with a redhead on his arm. I don't know. We want to know all those details. But so what I'm going to ask them to do is to, we're just going to start over here on the right with Norm and have them introduce themselves. And I'd like you to tell them who you are and what you did at Thurlow. And then you can launch into your story. And then we'll go to Bill and you do the same thing. And then Walt will bring up the end. And then once Walt is finished, we're going to open it up to the audience. Okay? So I give you Norman.
Okay. I was a pilot, and
I was
423rd, and my name's Norman Armbrust.
Okay.
And I'd like to talk about something that none of us wanted to think about, being shot down. On July 26, 1943, we got shot down. And a lot of people think when you got shot down was a poor pilot. Well, I don't think that way. Maybe it is, but look at the pilots that got shot down on their 25th mission. Look at the pilots that finished their 25 and volunteered for five more and got shot down on their 26. Did that. But what happened to us that day, we was flying off the lead ship, and that was the best position to me in the group. And he developed supercharger trouble. We were supposed to go over the target at 27,500 feet. And so to keep his airspeed up, he had to go downhill, and we crossed over the target at 26,500. The minute we dropped the bombs, we got a direct head flak. And all the planes shot by us, and I looked down to airspeed and was sitting on zero. That gives you a good feeling. And we didn't know it, but all of our instruments had been knocked out. And so we dove down on the lower echelon, and they walked away and left us like we standing still. Number one engine flew back past the tail. Number two quit on us, and then we'd fly on three and four, and three quit, and we had to feather it, and then when number four caught a fire, it was time to bail out. We figured we was about 18,000 feet. We don't know, we're just guessing at it, and when they bailed out. And the thing that you've got to remember, most generally, when a plane is knocked out of formation, those fighters pounced on him, but we didn't have no fighter escort, pounced on him, and he was dead duck in no time, but nobody jumped on us. We got about a third way out of Germany when we was bailing out. A Ju-88 came up and started strafing us. There were just three of us in the plane left. They missed all three of us, and we bailed out and came on down. And then they was waiting on us down there. And I never had no experience bailing out. Only I knew he had pulled ripcord. I don't know how many hours it took me to get down there. Or it seemed that way anyhow. You know, you look up at that sky, it doesn't get any farther away, and the ground's not getting any farther away. So fine. I was trying to do a delayed jump of that Ju-88 out there, and I didn't want him to shoot at me. And so I finally decided I better pull ripcord. So I did. so that got down. Is that enough?
No, what was your turn?
Tell us what happened to you on the ground.
Well, they was working in the field right there with the side cutting down wheat, and then the women was tying it up with the wheat and stacking it, and they was standing there and they seen me coming down, and I landed in a tree. When it's coming down, it was in the woods, and you don't want to come down on them trees because you'll run a limb right up through you and kill you. And there's a little, looked like a cart wheel about that big around. It was bigger than that, but that's what it looked from the air. And how I did it, nobody knows, but I slipped my chute in there. And I got down past those trees when a gust of wind hit me and threw me into the trees. But I had my Mae West on, and I put my arms up. I lost a little hide, but nothing that hurt. And then I, getting out of the chute was a little trouble. And they was waiting on the ground with a Luger. We never carried no guns. They give us a .45, but you just be same as committing suicide, as far as that's concerned. And they had us all, they had all of our boys gathered up. My bald hair boy died in the hospital. And we had three boys that was wounded. And then they took us and put us in jail. And then they took us on and put us in solitary confinement. We was in solitary confinement for 7 days till there were so many of the airmen shot down that they didn't have room for them, so they had to move us out so they could bring them in there and interrogate them. And the thing of it is, interrogation, them Germans knew more about the field than we did. Our job was to fly, and that's what we was. We didn't worry about the rest of the field. We've learned to fly because a lot of us, see, I was shot down 6 months after I got my wings. So we had a lot to learn, and we was learning. And so, but what they was trying to do is throw questions at you and then watch your face. You know, it's hard if they hit on something and you know about to keep your face straight. And that's what they was looking for. But they didn't get anything, only name, rank, and serial number the boys gave them. Then they moved us on into Stalag Roof 3. That's where The Great Escape was. You was probably seen that show. I was there when that
What camp was you in?
Huh?
What camp in Stalag Roof 3 were you in?
At the Tsagan.
I know where you said. I was in it myself. I said, what were you in the center compound?
Stalag Roof 3.
I know that. I say, what compound were you in?
What compound?
What part of Stalag?
What compound? I was in the south compound.
South, okay.
I was in the center when we first got
that's
there.
That's where I wound up.
And then they built the south, and then they took all the Americans out of the center and north camp and put them in the south compound. And Vince said they had to build a west compound for the Americans. Yeah. You was there.
I was in the center all the time, but they... as they moved the Brits out, and then as they filled it, but they're pulling up with America. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. What was your target when you got knocked out? What was your target? What city?
What was your target?
What was our target? Hanover.
Hanover.
We was on Hanover. Okay. That was my co-pilot was Kramer. Had his first grade with me. And I think it was his first grade and his last one. And he thought we was bombing his uncle's factories. He had an uncle. His dad had come over to America, and he was born over here. But his uncle was over in Germany, and he was pretty sure that was one of his factories that we bombed that day in Hanover.
How old were you?
About 22 or 23. About 23 then. And then in... January 45, when the rations were coming, they moved us to Mooseburg. Started out at midnight, and it was about 10 to 20 below zero. And they marched us at night and then put us in the barns in the daytime. And the rations for the day was 5 loaf of bread and 1/4 pound of marge. We used the marge to rubber shoes would try to turn the water to keep her feet. We lost out of 2,000 men on that march. We lost about 100, froze to death or died of exhaustion. And we got down. Moose Park, that was down there. And Patton came and liberated us.
What was Mooseburg? Was that called a stalag?
Yeah, you're going to have to hear.
Did Mooseburg have a stalag number?
Yeah, but
it was
offlag.
Huh?
It wasn't a stalag, it was an offlag.
Seven, wasn't it?
Seven, yeah, offlag seven. It wasn't a stalag. The House of Politicians in the end.
But there were all nationalities down there when we went down there.
Now, I've got a photograph of the day that the at of Mooseburg, of the guys inside the thing cheering as the tanks came in. Mm-hmm. And some of those tankers, it's kind of ironic, some of those tankers were from Abilene.
Yeah. We had one boy there that was fighting for the town at that time, and everybody was hugging the floor pretty much in the barracks, and he was setting up at the table, and they said, "Oh, they ain't gonna bother you." About that time, a bullet came in there and ricocheted around, ended up landing on the table in front of him. The boy said, "You never seen anybody get on the ground on the horse fast in all your life."
Well, Norman,
a little humor and everything.
We'll come back to Norman for questions at the end. Let's move on and stay there because we're going to have some questions for you. And let's move on to Bill. Tell us who you are and what you did at Thurlow.
I was the medical NCO with the 367th Bomb Squadron. I joined the 306th at Wendover on June the 4th, and on June the 10th they assembled us out in front to be greeted by the next to the general.
Colonel?
And it was Curtis LeMay. I looked him in the eye and scared the hell out of him. He had a habit of doing that. And he said that in his diary, which I have a copy of, he said that Wendover, in all his years he was in service prior to coming World War II, Wendover was the worst bug post he ever had. And so we left in August 31st, we entrained for Richmond, Virginia, which was a state staging station. We stayed there a month, got some more training, and then we moved to Trenton, New Jersey. We boarded the Queen Elizabeth on the 4th of June. Okay, I'm getting my dates mixed up. But anyways, on the 4th of September, we boarded the Queen Elizabeth. And we enjoyed the trip with 16,000 other troops. And you won't believe this, but we set up a dispensary on the Queen Elizabeth to take care of people. Most of them were seasick. Some of them had never seen salt water. And we took care of them for 5 days, performing first aid things. We got to Thurlow on the 4th of September. Yeah, 4th of September we got to Thurlow, or the 5th of September. And we were assigned to a station hospital with 28 beds. And we were mixed in with an RAF group, enlisted master sergeant, and six of his people who were there to provide transition to the way you do things in the war zone. So we slept in the barracks with those enlisted men. The officers had their own barracks. And it was quite an experience, and you would think that we would have had some problems relative to being from two different cultures, or almost two different cultures, but we got along just fine. We set up our organization so that we would have sick call in the morning in the traditional Army way. But after a couple of weeks of that, our commanding officer, at that time Major Short, established no sick call. You're on duty 24/7. I can't tell you how many times I had first flashlights in my eyes at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. We slept right behind the bomb shelter. And I have a flashlight in my eyes saying, hey, hold it. We need some help. Here's what's wrong with me. Fix me up. Our main mission was to take care of the combat men. We'd be on the flight line when the missions took off. We'd be on the flight line when the missions came back. When the missions came back, if they had any casualties, they would shoot off a red flare, which would alert us to it. We'd go out to small paths on adjacent to the runway, and we would follow the plane down. They did that for quite a while, and then eventually they said, no, that's too dangerous. There's others coming back, but coming in behind you that are already shot the heck. So they stopped that practice. But we would go into the plane, find out where the casualty was, and see how bad he was. If he was mobile, we would give him an injection to beef up his good points. And but if he was shot up pretty bad, we would put him in. We had a bamboo litter that we acquired from the RAF, and we would put them in this bamboo litter. It would immobilize all their joints. And you needed that, especially if you wanted to get somebody out through the nose, as you guys know. And so that's just about it. We had 24, like I said, we had 24/7 service. And most of us stayed on the base. We did have the highest VD rate for 2 months. And I took care of a couple of doctors myself. They didn't want their fellow doctors to know. We had one group surgeon, four flight surgeons, squadron flight surgeon. We started off with about 18 enlisted men. We eventually wound up with considerably more. We had probably about 20 doctors, dentists, and all the other things, and the flight surgeon. And we had a total complement in June of 1943 of 38 people. Of the 38 people, there are four of us alive today. All of us are gone. God rest their souls. And we had one medic in our group that he was in your squadron, Phil, Bob Spry. He and his friend wanted to go on combat. Why did they want to go on combat? I said, you guys crazy? You have to see no body we drag out? Do you want to go on combat? You're crazy. He said, well, we'll get more pay. He said, we'll have more time in London. So, to finish up on those two, on a mission in August 1944, they were the last plane off for the mission. They took off on a short runway. And when they became airborne, they got the whiplash from the plane that they'd just taken off in front of them. And they crashed in the site where the 367th was domiciled. And out of that, the two medics and the pilot and the co-pilot came out alive, but the other six were killed. By the time we got the four casualties back to the hospital, the bombs exploded and blew out almost all the windows in the hospital. And we were quite a ways away from the crash site. I finished up in August of 1945, came back on the Queen Mary with 5,000 troops, no 60 men. And that's about all I have to say.
I want to we'll ask some questions later, but I want you to tell them about Dr. Schuller and his solution to the VD problem.
Officers came down from Air Force headquarters. Officers were not to be identified as having VD. They had a cold. So Dr. Schuller took umbrage with this, you know, and he said, well, why should we have a difference? So he wrote a letter to headquarters, went over the Surgeon General of the 8th Air Force's head, and had the policy changed.
Okay.
Now, okay, that's about it.
Okay. Well, I'll back up your story one thing. When I got to my first time, I got to my billet, they had the Jolly Roger, yellow and black.
Yeah,
Jolly Roger. And I said, what's a Jolly Roger doing up there? We got the highest rating in the game.
Well, you know, we do what a short arm inspection is. For you people that don't know what short arm is, you have to go, you know, either line up the troops or go through the barracks. And we went through the barrack at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we would say, have the men come down and milk their penis to see if there's any discharge. If there were, we send them out to the ambulance and send them back to the hospital. Every once in a while, you'd get somebody that would not come out of the bed in the barrack. We ripped the blanket back, and there was some lady in there.
Yeah, let me get all this down now.
I never participated.
Oh, okay. Well, let's move on to Walt, our president, and he'll tell us a little bit about his experiences. Then we'll open it up to the whole group, and I've got one more question for Bill before I open it up to you guys. Walt?
I got over there.
Tell who you are.
Oh, I'm Walt Rosette, and I was a pilot in the 369th. And I got over there I flew my first mission in October 1944, which was a better time to start than in 1943. And I'll start with my first medical, my only medical experience since Bill has gone up to his. In November, we were bombing, I don't even remember the name of the target, but we were bombing and I got hit on the bomb run. And a piece of flak about as big as my thumb came through the electrical instrument panel next to the pilot's left leg, came through the bottom seat of the airplane and hit me in the rear end. And of course, when you get hit like that, you don't know how badly you're hurt. And I had my co-pilot take it, and you know, you got a flak suit on and the oxygen mask and everything else. You can't move around. But I finally figured out that I was not badly hurt. I had a cut in my leg from a piece of the glass that came in. And I had this rear end that was kind of hurting. I was sitting on two of those yellow cushions that day, and it broke all four sides of the two cushions. It was just fortunate because if I had not been sitting on the two of them, it would have been an inch inside of me. But in any event, when we got back over the channel, if you had wounded on board, you could head straight back to the field, which I do if you did. And when you come into land, as Joe mentioned, you shot off a red flare if you had wounded on board. And I had determined at that point that I really wasn't hurt that badly. So my engineer said, you got to let me shoot the red flare off because it's the only time we're going to have the opportunity to do this. This is about mission number 15 or so. And I finally said to him, okay, shoot off the red thread. And he shot off the red and every other flare we have in the airplane. And obviously the ambulance guys took me over to the infirmary and they gave me a tetanus shot, put a little Band-Aid on my leg, and I was so badly wounded that I was scheduled to fly the following day. But if you, and I didn't put in for a Purple Heart because, as a matter of fact, a guy in our squadron that day, a gunner, lost an eye, and my injury was not quite comparable. However, if you do get hit by enemy action and hit and get medical attention, you're entitled to the Purple Heart. So 61 years later, in 2005, I had my Purple Heart awarded to me at a ceremony in Woodland, California. So I know. But I went through a couple of dramatic missions. Christmas Eve, 1944, we had been grounded for about 2 weeks because of the weather. And they decided that they were either going to get the 8th Air Force all off the ground, or maybe they were going to have to get out of Europe, because the Battle of the Bulge was going on. Well, we took off that morning. The only time I ever made an instrument takeoff, I could not see the wingtip of the airplane. And well, my co-pilot was looking down to see the edge of the runway, and we did take off, but there were more people killed in takeoff that day than there were from enemy action. I then, in January, became a lead pilot, and I my first target was the Hohenzollern Bridge outside of Cologne, and we were carrying 500-pound bombs. We really should have been carrying 1,000-pounders. We did hit the bridge with 3 500-pound bombs. It didn't go in the water immediately, but 3 days later it fell in the water. And if you ever go to Cologne, you'll see postcards of this W-shaped bridge sitting in the water. I had a mission in, as a matter of fact, Don Snook, I guess he's, Don isn't here, but Don flew this with me, but this was in late March of 1945. We were carrying externally slung rocket-propelled bombs. Yeah. There was one 4,200-pounder under each wing. When we took off, we were 5,000 pounds beyond the red line for the V-17. Had to rendezvous at 18,000 feet because you just couldn't climb the formation.
Well, the curvature of the earth allowed you to get off the ground.
It was a long trip on the runway. In any event, we got to the target. The target was a town called Vladisac outside of Hamburg. We were bombing submarine bombs. These bombs, incidentally, were built by the British, developed by the British. And we, it was about 50% cloud cover. We were flying Vinegrove 313. Vinegrove was the code name for the 8th Air Force. And one was the 1st Division, two was the 2nd, and we were in the 3rd Division. And then the group number came next, and 13 was the last, so we were flying the last group in the 8th Air Force that day. And we were flying instead of the normal group of 36, there were only 12. We had two squadrons of 6 airplanes each because the bomb had to be concentrated on the target or it was just going to go 500 feet into the ground and that was it. Well, we made the first run on the target and the flak was on us the first time. Had to stay at exactly 20,000 feet because the rocket mechanism cut in at 10,000 feet, and we made the first run, and the bombardier lost the target at the last minute. We couldn't drop the bombs, but we lost the number 2 engine on the first run, and of course we had been hit in various and sundry places on the plane, but nobody was hurt. So we made the second run, and it was a good run, but unfortunately, on the first run, they got the bomb release mechanism, and the net result was the bombs didn't go. So we made a third run. And the third run, unfortunately, the bombardier again lost the target at the last minute, and we made a fourth run. And we finally dropped the bombs. We had only 5 planes in our squadron, one of them had aborted. And we did, there were only 9 bombs that could have hit the target. because one of ours was going to be wasted. Of the nine bombs, we did get three of them right on the target. And we, of course, when you lose an engine, because the airplane isn't flying straight, it's flying this way, you can see that you lose an awful lot of power because you're fighting against the wind hitting the side of the airplane and the tail. And Major Witt, who was the squadron commander of, I think it was the 368, but I'm not sure. He was the command pilot with me. And I talked to him about whether we go to Holland. I had suggested we go to Holland instead of going back to England. But he wanted to go to England, and he was a major, and I was his first lieutenant at the time. And the net result was we went to England. And we landed at the first air base we could land at, and we had 5 minutes of fuel left. And if we had had to go around, we might not have made it. But it was a great experience, all things being considered. I became assistant operations officer of the company of the squadron, and we then wound up going through that picture taking, that stereoptic map of all of Europe that was being done. And we were down in Marrakesh in Africa for a while, and finally got home in October, in late September of 1945. But that's my story.
Thank you. Let me make an announcement before we proceed with questions. The schedule is wrong. This is not 2 hours, it's 1 hour, because we have that reception, that wonderful reception that the hotel's giving us for free with food and liquor at 5 up in the hospitality room. So we will stop at 4:30. That'll give you a half hour to freshen up and get to the hospitality room, where we'll visit a little bit. I think the balcony's going to be open, and it'll be a fun time. Bill, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the first mission that the 306 flew, and what was the consequences for your squadron? What do you remember about that day?
We lost the first plane and that of the group, and they all became POWs. They all became POWs. We had sent up 19 to 20 planes, and we lost just one, and happened to be in my squadron. And this was a portent of what was to come, because among the 306 bomb group, we had the highest rate of casualties of any of the other squadrons. Maybe the other squadrons were managed better. I know I have had a good friend who told me you didn't have good management, but anyway. The one person that came, the first number, POW number one for the 306 bomb group, was a character. He was a navigator. Do you know what his name was?
Olson?
I can't think of it either. But when he came back from overseas, he wrote a book later on that's a classic. And the name of the book is So Long, Boys, I Dearly Love You, something like that. And it's a classical written book. And I would invite any of you that can get a copy of it to do so. One other thing I want to mention about Dr. Schuller. When I joined them in 1942, he was a captain and a flight surgeon, 369. The man who was the group surgeon was promoted. Dr. Schuller became the group surgeon because he had the highest seniority. It wasn't because he had the most skill, but he had the highest seniority. But he really did have the most skill, it turned out. From there, while he was in that position, he griped about, what do the boys have to look forward to? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel? You know, what am I going to be faced with when tomorrow morning comes, or tomorrow afternoon, and I take off? Am I going to get shot up? Am I going to become a POW? Or am I going to be blown apart? I don't know. And they had a very fatalistic attitude about this, and some of them went crazy. Not crazy, I don't mean actually, head crazy, they just did crazy things. Because they figured, tomorrow's probably my last day. Well, Dr. Schiller got enough of that, he got enough complaints. And he wrote a letter to the commanding officer of the 306 to be forwarded up to 8th Air Force headquarters and reminding the general, whoever, what his name was, I have short-term memory.
General Eaker.
Eaker.
Yeah, we all.
Yeah. Anyways, they wrote a letter and said, you've got to set a target for them to meet. If you want to maintain any morale for the combat men, you've got to establish a target. He recommended 20 missions. He also reminded the general that shortly after the 8th Air Force moved over to England in August of 42, and this same general said, well, I'll give our boys a target that they can shoot at so that we can maintain the morale. They also reminded him in this letter what he had promised, and he didn't do it. So the general decided 25 missions and they're out. So we moved on as hostility became lessened, more fighter planes, less casualties, and they increased it to 30 missions and then to 35. Then he was promoted to 1st Division Headquarters as a 1st Division Surgeon. And he went on to do many other things that were remarkable, which saved the lives of many of the combat men. I have his diary, his day-to-day diary, and it's the most fascinating piece of work I've ever seen. He missed very few days in the annotating in that diary what happened. Vernon asked him for the diary one day, and he told Vernon, I'm not going to give it to you until 2015, because by that time, all the people I mentioned in my diary would be dead. Is that right, Vernon?
Yeah, but he's giving it to me.
Did he give it to you?
Yeah.
Then I don't have to leave it to you in my will.
No, I've got it.
You got to think about publishing it, you know?
He's still
Yeah, he's 97 years old. And I hope you'll get to go to Savannah. Let's open it up. I know Ken has a question. Let's just open it up to the panel. Ken?
Is his doctor going to open his book up, or are you going to wait for
Well, what pass? He told me was that he was not interested in doing that, and he was concerned about some of the comments he made at the time would hurt some of the people or their families. And one of the reasons he gave it to me is that I was writing an article on military medicine and the development of military medicine in World War II. I'm going to have a conversation with him, hopefully that he will be able to maybe let us do something with it. I don't know. Any questions now for anyone on the panel? Right there.
Those wonderful pictures. These guys holding up the town and putting the smoke remarks on the ceiling. You know the ones I'm talking about?
Yeah, you're crying.
When did that practice, we either got the ceiling too dirty, or when did they quit?
When they got too many missions.
I don't know.
When they got the ceiling on the
floor. Well, see, I realized that. What do you guys tell me when I started? Because I got in there, they were cleaning the ceiling. And I have yet to find out. I did 35 missions, and I don't know where the hell I was in this whole thing. I didn't find out.
Well, there's a pub in Cambridge where they moved to, I guess after they ran out of ceiling room at Thurlow, they went to Cambridge. And those are still there. You can go and look at them.
Not really. I'm going to explain exactly what.
They were smoking cigars and getting the smoke coming off of the cigars.
Yeah, and it, the objective was to write something in smoke on the top of the Nissan Hut, the headquarters for the squadron. And it was various and sundry comments about missions and
people. Try to write on the ceiling of the calendar sometimes.
It would name the target in the date.
That was common in a lot of...
It would say St. Desire, October 15th, whatever it was.
Any other questions over here?
Going back to 12 o'clock high, they had the mug they would turn around in the officers' club. It was obviously about the 306th. Did you have, did we have, did they have a mug like that where you knew there was a mission the next day? For anybody in the audience?
No, that was Hollywood.
That was Hollywood. I just...
Right, that's Dean Jagger.
Yeah. Well, if anybody is interested in 12 o'clock high, get a copy of Air Force Magazine of January this year, where the title of the last article in the book was, "We Want to Dispel the Myth of 12 o'clock high." They identified that the 306 was the primary emphasis for which the movie was made. Chip Oberatto was our commanding officer. He was replaced by a major general. He was replaced by a general who became a major general after being there 24 days. And he was turned over, he came in to bolster the morale of all the troops. Well, I never saw him, so I don't know what he did. He only lasted about 24 days, and then they promoted him to brigadier general.
That's Frank Armstrong, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about him at the Friday night dinner tomorrow night.
I would just mention the business of losing airplanes. I flew 33 missions. The 369th never lost an airplane on a mission that I flew. And there were missions in between that we lost half the squadron. One more clear-cut illustration: if you have to choose between lucky and smart, choose lucky.
Yeah.
You had a good commanding officer.
Yes, we did have a good commanding officer. I did have one incident. I was flying in the number four position behind the lead airplane, and when you get over the channel, the gunners clearly put some live ammunition into their guns. Well, the lead airplane, one of the gunners, cleared some live shells out, and they came back and hit my number two engine and set it on fire. And I had no choice but to abort the mission, which I dutifully did. And the guy who filled in my place was shot down.
Lucky.
Yes. But he fortunately got back to friendly territory, and they all survived.
Any other questions?
Another one from this side, if I don't mind. Norm, it sounds like you flew a B-17F, is that correct?
Do you fly a B-17F, Norm?
Did I fly?
Yeah, was it an F one?
Yeah, not a G. E or F?
It was an F.
Or F, and Bill, you flew a G?
I
flew B's and
F's
and
G's. It wasn't an F. Yeah,
was that the chin turn?
No, the G had the chin turn.
My question was, the P-51 obviously made things a lot easier in the second half of the war, but I've never seen anything written whether the F model, when they went to the G model, when they came out with that chin turn, helped the problem with the, it didn't duck as good.
Psychologically it did.
Did, but that's about it.
From the line of sight to the line of bore was 55 inches, and I defy anybody to hit anything with a 55-inch span between a gun and a sight.
All it really did, so far as I know, is that the fighters that used to come in on a pursuit curve and take your chance with tail gunners and waist gunners gave that crap up, and they went out here and they drive up alongside about 45-degree angle. You could watch them roll up and come through inverted.
Yeah.
And they wanted to head on, and they figured if they could hit anybody in the airplane, they could go right through it and take anybody in the crew out, starting with the pilot. A nice theory. The thing that's interesting was that I'm driving along doing my schedule. I don't want to be here. I'm driving along, and big as life, out of the corner of my eye, I saw one ME-109 fly by. And he was taking hits
on the underside of his fuselage. That hull on the 109 has a long flat slab bottom to it, and they had had trouble trying to protect their pilots, and they didn't want to put too much armor plate in there for that weight penalty. So what they did was they did the whole underbody, they covered it pretty well. So, okay, the guy comes through, if he's getting shot at, he's not going to get hurt. And I'm driving along to it, and I'm just perfectly out of the corner of my eye, I see hits on this guy as he goes by. He's inverted, going down through there, and I see hits, and there's chunks of German aircraft flying off of that thing. Some are going straight up, and some are going out both ways. So what that means is there's a waste gunner over here, and there's a waste gunner over here who are scoring hits on that airplane. And perhaps somebody else, I don't know, but chunks of it coming up, and that guy went down and came back up and went back to work again. That makes a hell of a deal. That's got to be a gutsy son of a gun. But think about how durable the thing was. But, you know, this guy can now go back and say, I shot down an ME-109. And this guy can say the same thing. And you had all these things, you know, we wiped out the Luftwaffe in the first month. I never came to any of these things because I wanted to give them about 40, 50 years to boil this down to real numbers. But you guys that were senior to me in that thing, doing this Cadillac, the guys that, through that 43 period of time, I have nothing but total admiration for any of you guys that are here.
My gunners never fired a gun. Never saw an enemy aircraft.
Holy smoke.
Wow. On 33 missions.
Holy smoke.
That's got to be something.
Well, there was one Cessna one time.
Vernon, you should remind everyone here, you mentioned your talk tomorrow night, Friday night dinner. Mm-hmm. If people haven't bought tickets yet and want to, we have a few more tickets upstairs, but we need to have a final count by 6 p.m. today of who's going to the Friday night dinner.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So you'll be up in the room. You'll be up in the room. That's for people that haven't got tickets. If you bought your tickets already, you're in the camp.
Oh, well, what the hell?
We're talking about people that maybe want to pick up a ticket and hadn't planned on going. When you go up to the reception, just check in with our registration desk if you want to pick up a ticket for either one of the tours or either one of the dinners. We still have a few tickets left. When those are gone, they're gone. That's it. Okay, more questions? We've got still about 12 minutes left. Over here.
I've been thinking about this, so I had to write it. But when an airman failed to return to the base at Turlai, what happened to his personal belongings? Did he have a footlocker? And was it shipped home to his family in the States? What happened to anything that was...
That's a very sensitive area.
Yes, it was right there.
Many times, their fellow soldiers took out all the goodies and left the other things.
Yeah.
The commanding officers eventually put a stop on that. And they were put under the custody of somebody appointed in the barracks, like a barrack chief. And that person was responsible for that missing person's personal effects.
And then it was, if he was a POW, then things were shipped home, or?
I talked to a fella in the Quartermaster Corps about this a week ago, Virgil Limpino. He can't be here at this reunion. And he assured me that after they started shipping men home, that he and a few others in the quartermaster group of the 306th were having to dismantle the various barracks, stack up all the beds, move them to Germany to where they were going to be used over there. They were having to ship home footlockers. My uncle's footlocker got home to my grandmother. What she did with it after that, I don't know, but at any rate, my part of the family was further away. He said that they had a number of men coming back to Turlai after they'd been released from the POW camps and asking if their stuff was still there. And he said, all I can tell them is, it's being shipped to your family, so talk to your family. So
I got home 3 days late one time. We sort of smashed up a B-17 landing in Belgium, and I came home in a C-47 3 days later, and all that was left of my belongings was my shoes, because I wore a big slug. It took me about a week to get all my gear back.
I had a bunk man. You know, I was going on one of these really tricky operations. I think it was peanut butter, besides the point. And I'm getting up now, go about my thing, and I'm about to get out of that. And here I see this long, scrawny arm reach out for these custom-made British Dodd-Purse. I was very, very happy with just having recently acquired. Slid them back under his bunk. That's just in case, buddy.
I bought the Navigator was the only one that could carry, when we flew overseas, could have a footlocker, because all the navigation books. And I threw those all out, and I bought all the liquor and filled it up in that footlocker for the group, okay? I mean, for the crew.
Well, lots of times they were incriminating things in their personal. some of the fellows would take out those incriminating things and burn them and leave the residue, and then they would split up the residue. It all depended upon the barracks chief. He was the one that made the determination.
In my case, the barracks chief had my short jacket. They stole everything I had when I was moving.
He's still looking for it, so he took it. Oh, no. Yes.
Yeah. I went on the 15th of February in 45. All of my belongings were eventually shipped to my parents. Problem was that after BJ Day, when I was finally repatriated, and got back to El Monte, California, my folks said, that big box came from someplace in Liverpool. It must be for you. There was practically nothing that was usable. It evidently had been flooded or something, because everything was molded. I salvaged out of it a silver cigarette case. As far as I'm concerned, all my belongings were there. It's just that the way they were handled made them useless.
And of course, there wasn't any insurance.
Any other questions?
I would mention that you mentioned this, a footlocker full of booze. One of the things that I did was I volunteered every month to take the booze trip up to Aberdeen, Scotland, where we got our liquor for the base. And I did that because when you got back, you got the first crack at the liquor, and the liquor ranged from absolutely undrinkable to the pretty good stuff, and that gave me a good choice.
Did you fly up a B-17?
Yes.
Well,
we didn't drink it until we got there.
Early on, good liquor was, until I the second last stop before I flew over. Right. I made a parade. The only reason you're can't get out of the wires because you're headed for combat. I got a telegram apparently from my brother at the post office, and they let me off the base. So now I walk all the way through this town from one tavern to another tavern, and you couldn't find a bottle of bourbon anywhere. And so I walked into one. And he said, no, we don't have it. And I happened to lean over the bar, and there was a whole gallon bottle of Jim Beam. And we used to have in our old friendly taverns, when we'd empty that bottle, then you'd put money in it for the tavern party, you know. And that's probably what they were saying, but I said, I want that bottle. Now I carry that bottle in my arm. Oh, I also stopped off at a drugstore, and I bought the whole table of lipstick and compacts and stockings. That was the other bag I had to carry. So now I'm walking down the street, and you know, the GIs and whatnot, they'd never salute an Air Force guy, you know. But I got them right and left walking all through the town, and I couldn't do anything about it.
brings up a story about the medics and alcohol. When you came back from a mission, you were offered a little, about a 1 ounce of whiskey.
A shot.
Well, the officer took care of that first, the flight surgeon. But after a while, they turned it over to the enlisted men, like they turned a lot of unhealthy ideas over to the enlisted men. And we had, so we say, they come in off the mission, prior to interrogation, do you want your whiskey? You don't want your whiskey? Okay. We'll put a mark over there, that's for the medics. This is for the troops. So we gathered quite a bit of booze that way. took you people to the cleaners.
Question.
What the hell were you doing? You're a big dragon.
Of course.
Question. The medical emergency kit that came to the pilot as you got aboard and was one of the first of your people to get it when we got back.
Right.
All right, the morphine that was in there, at what level or quantity, should we say, of morphine were we talking about at that time?
You mean the quantity of morphine?
Right.
About a half an ounce, 1 ounce.
Okay. But it was generally missing. It generally wasn't there.
Maybe in the urine.
You know, we had a drug problem for a while. They would go into the airplane and pull out the morphine and take it personally.
Right. Yep. Of course.
And they finally got up a group of MPs that were guarding the planes to make sure they weren't stealing the morphine. Can you imagine what would happen if you get up on a flight and you were wounded and you couldn't have a...
Right.
There was no cassette of morphine there for you? So it was a serious situation.
Yeah.
You know, you think of that in the context of today's various drug problems, particularly in the United States, and how naive we were, but it was proper and right, and it certainly served its purpose.
Amen.
Any final questions? We've got about 3 minutes.
I've got one about leave in London. I read in a letter my wife's dad wrote about always getting the top floor of the hotel. That whenever they were, you know, the Germans were the bombing London, and all the hotel rooms were empty at the top floors. Is that true? You guys always got put in the top floor of the hotel, or you never experienced that yourself?
I always slept in the Red Cross Club. One of the cleanest places in London.
Yeah, it was cheap, too.
And that was a hell of a place to rest.
What was it? Red Cross Club.
We had a Red Cross truck at Bedford, right? I came back from London one night, and there's one lonely officer over in the corner, and he's busy handwriting a letter of some sort. And I got a cup of coffee and sat on, and I looked over and I recognized who it was. That's our famous band leader that went down. And that was 2 or 3 days prior to his being mocked.
Lynn Miller.
One of the nicest men you could ever meet, soft, easy spoken, and he's sharing with me this letter he's just gotten from his wife, and she wanted to know whether the price of asphalting in her driveway was reasonable. One of those kind of conversations.
You know? Well, he was frequently playing at the Red Cross in Bedford on Saturday nights.
Yeah.
But such an easy to approach, pleasant.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want him as your guy.
One other medical situation, may amuse you, may not. When we first went there, we set up a VD prevention in the Red Cross Club, on whatever that road was. And the city fathers got unhappy about that, so we had to move the station to an ambulance that we parked between two theaters over in the west bank of the River Ouse.
Yes.
And that went along fine for a long time. We would take care of somebody who would have an episode and would come in and we would give them the treatment and hoping that it would cure any venereal disease. But on one night, the two guys that were running it, they invited two of the local ladies in. Had a good time. That stopped it. From that time on, we set up a station right in the middle of town. To hell with the town fathers.
Let me close by saying two things. Number one, I think at the next reunion, we're going to maybe have two or three of these where we have three or four veterans on a round table and do this and spread it out through the reunion. I think it's been very successful. I've been at a number of other bomb group reunions where they've done this, and this ours is, of course, much better than theirs. But we'll do that in the schedule for next year. Also, I have a couple of two or three spots left on the dinner program and the banquet for people to lead invocation and the benediction, the closing prayer. And I wasn't going to ask anyone, I was just going to make an announcement. So if you'd be willing to do one of those, if you could just stop by and tell me so that I might get your name. And otherwise, everything else is set. We've got reception in 30 minutes, so you've got 30 minutes to take a break. And I'm not sure if they're going to have that closed off while they're setting it up or what. But 5 o'clock, please come in and we'll have some fellowship together. Thank you for coming. Yes. The Harborview Room on 5th floor, 5 o'clock, it'll be 1 hour long.